you have received the agenda in your packets. Are there any additions or corrections? Mr. Baker?
No.
If not, I'll entertain a motion to approve the agenda.
So move you.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carried. Approval of the minutes, the May 5th meeting minutes were in your packet. Are there any changes? If not, I'll consider the minutes approved. Reading of correspondence, Mr. Griffin.
I seem to have one item. If anyone has anything else, please feel free to pass it down. This letter appears to be from the SBA Network Services, Inc. This letter is sent to Mr. Baker, submitted in great appreciation for the service rendered, service provided to us by Megan Nerbas. It says, in their efforts to complete due diligence for the acquisition of 11 telecommunications towers, they requested verification of 9/11 address, and Ms. Nerbas was very instrumental and helpful in providing that manner in a timely fashion. Also, thank you note from Vince Robertson thanking counsel for reappointing him as assistant county attorney. And that's all the correspondence I have.
Does counsel have any correspondence they'd like to share? If not, I'll ask Mr. Eric Swanson, our county sheriff, if he'd like to come forward. Good afternoon, Sheriff.
Afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You too, Vance. I just come here to propose some changes in the fees that we're charging for our services out at the sheriff's office. The big one would be 19. We have a cap on selling lands and tenements right now at $250,000, where we can only get $10,000. I propose an increase up to $15,000, just a $5,000 increase, where Kent has no cap right now, and Newcastle's entertaining the same idea, raising it to 15. Now, in 2008, if we had the $5,000 increase, it would have brought in an additional $200,000. And as of this year, right now, 2009 with the sales, we're at $200,000 right now with it, and we just completed sales today, and we still have June. So that's be probably at least another $25,000, $30,000 till the end of the year for the increases. I also have just a moderate fee to cover our charges from $5 to $7.50 for a certified mail. Post offices just changed their fees to increase. Due to some of the properties, we have to send alias summonses out to, which is an extra mailing that will cover our costs just to keep us afloat. Replevins, it helped increase the revenue there. Also with the second mortgage notices, and proposing our goods and chattels fee on just the cars, TVs, whatever, go from 3% to 4%, just to keep it on line with the council fee for selling lands. Also, it's not a fee increase, it's just a deposit requiring us to set up the sheriff's sales. Right now, the it's a $500 deposit, where the fees and all for newspapers have increased. We're waiting, because most of them are over the $500. We just proposed $1,000, so we don't have to wait for the money to come here. We already have it, and we can just send them a refund out. They're the fees proposals I propose.
Okay. Does the council have any questions for Mr. Swanson? Ms. Deaver?
No. Do we have an ordinance for this now?
An ordinance that's been...
We always did have an ordinance.
We always did. It's just to change some of the fees in there.
Okay, is this something we're going to discuss? What is this?
It is your opportunity to discuss it now, Ms. Deaver.
If you have any questions, I mean, it's the first we've heard of it, so, but go ahead.
Yeah, I do. Is it mainly, I hear you saying to catch up with the fees that, you know, I charge at the post office, but is this mainly to catch up with fees that are increasing, or is what is the...
Well, it's not, or the fee for the mail, it is.
Mm-hmm, sure, I understand that.
We're sending, most of the time, we're sending two deputies to do replevins or levies on property. That will cover the cost of that extra deputy, because through mailings we're getting, phone calls, we're having threats made, basically what it is. The other day, we went to do a levy, and the person had a loaded gun sitting there, and we took care of it, but...
So these increased fees are to cover the cost?
Especially with the additional deputy, because we're sending two deputies a lot of these things now. And replevins, where the bank or somebody with a mobile home, they come to hook on and go. You know, it's just charging fees for our time.
Fees incurred, I understand, costs incurred, okay.
Gas is going up, postage, everything's going up, we're just trying to...
I understand.
Tread water there.
Okay, I understand.
Now, when you have the increase for your chattels and goods, selling goods?
Yes, sir.
I mean, you don't go someplace and just sell one TV, do you?
Sometimes they're vehicles, sometimes it's a lot. It'll be TVs, computers, you know, whatever they levied on.
Okay. And the 3% may not even cover your cost for that.
Right.
And 4%, or even 4%, depending on how much goods and chattels, I guess, you're selling, right?
Yeah, and what we just current with their...
So do you lose money there typically now? Historically, have you been losing money on the fee for selling?
Basically, yeah. When you send two deputies out, three deputies sometime, the sales... You know, the auctioneer has to be paid. And
right, okay. And then, do you have another question? I'm sorry.
No, I'm just making sure that it's to cover actual costs. That's what I'm interested in.
And that's what we're doing.
Okay, fine.
Right now.
I understand.
Well, then I got another one. And then, go right on down. The increase for the deposit, basically, that's refundable.
Yeah, whatever.
That's just to show up.
They'll get back.
If that's just to show up to bid at one of your auctions, you got to have
$1,000. No, that... this is for attorneys when we set the sale up. They send us a $500 deposit. They'll start.
This is just between attorneys and the
and the sheriff. Office, yes. And
heck, you ought to make that $10,000, that one.
Well, hey, that's your prerogative, Mr. Cole.
You're
getting an argument out of me.
I understand that better now. The final one here, the increase for the cap on a sheriff's sale. Now, you're talking about real estate in this one, right?
Yes.
So if you're selling a piece of property, and it only brings $8,000.
Maybe I didn't explain that well. There's a cap. Anything over $250,000, we get a flat $10,000 fee.
Okay, that's the cap.
That's the cap. We would just like to raise the cap. Anything over $250,000
to
$15,000.
Okay, on those expensive properties.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Do they require any more? Could maybe somebody else might ask this. Well, does it require any more effort out of your department? Or is it just because of the size of the amount?
It's the size and amount.
Okay.
Because we have some developments. We sold $9 million properties, $10 million properties, and you're only getting $10,000 on it. Like I said, whereas Kent County, they have no cap. So
your auctioneer is at one of these sales, right?
Yes.
Okay. How do you pay your auctioneers?
They get $100.
So when he sells a $250,000 house, he gets $100. He sells a $40,000
house. Yes. Now, sometimes what's been happening, they'll auctioneer, so they'll go and try and work a deal out with the attorney or whatever, try to get a certain percentage out of it. Whereas I already had it in the budget. We're going to the sheriff's office ourselves. We're going to start auctioning off
our own property
so we can keep that fee. As an extra source of revenue for the time and trouble.
Okay, all right. I know a couple auctioneers. I'm sure one of you guys could do it. Are you going to, I mean, do you intend to send them off to auctioneer school or anything like that, or possibly?
Oh, we'll look into it, but...
Okay, so the cap is on...
I got a general knowledge of doing it.
Well, that's a pretty reasonable fee, isn't it? $100.
Well, yeah, but he's...
He's selling a bunch of them that day.
He gets $100 each one.
Oh.
Right, which is...
Each property?
Right.
I can even sell a express wagon for that.
Okay, I guess I understand the cap now is $250,000. Anything under is still...
4%.
Just
on the lands and the houses, yes.
Okay, it's 4%, okay. All right, I'm done, Vance.
Mr. Vincent, have you anything?
No, sir.
Mr. Wilson?
Well, I haven't had time to look at it, but the general direction I think you're going taking is that you charge as much for a $300,000 house or more than you would a $200,000 house. But isn't there as much work goes in this same project, same as advertising?
Yeah, posting, mileage, going back and forth.
But I mean, it's about the same amount of work, isn't it? Wouldn't it be the same as you spent if you had a...
Well, it could be, but now we're using sometimes we're using two deputies to do these things.
Well, I would use any more deputies for a
$500,000,
you would a $100,000.
Officer safety when people call up and make threats.
Why? Because the bigger, the more expensive the house, more threats you got? Is that what you're saying?
No, some people don't like things taken away from them, Mr.
Wilson. I understand that. I'm trying to understand here because I haven't really, well, I think we need to defer it and look at it for a week.
Okay. Any other questions? If there is no objection from the council, we will defer this for a week. Give us time to take a look at it. Thank you very much, Mr. Swanson.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Izzo.
Sorry for a second. Good afternoon. I have just one item on my agenda, and it's in regards to a proposed design contract for the Oak Orchard expansion area number one. If you recall, 2 weeks ago, we came in with the consultant selection and we had recommended various firms for various projects. In this particular case, we are proposing a design contract with the firm of George Miles and Buehr, but they will also sub-consult out services to Cave Associates and Davis Bowen and Friedel. Basically, for Oak Orchard expansion number one, we anticipate there's going to be three separate contracts. So each firm would take one contract, but however, in the case of GMB, and I should mention we have Mr. Pete Bozick, who's a partner in the firm of George Miles and Buehr. In the case of GMB, they're actually going to oversee the work of the other two firms. In this case, we've received stimulus money for the Oak Orchard expansion area number one. We have an approximate $9 million loan, but $3 million of that is loan forgiveness. So I look at it as a grant. They call it loan forgiveness. But one of the caveats is that we award and execute contracts with the various contractors who've been on these projects by February 17, 2010. So we're on a relatively tight time frame to get all these contracts out on the street and meet these deadlines. It may be that we're able to cover the $9 million in two contracts, but it's a total $13 million project as far as the construction is concerned, and it may be that the stimulus money actually touches all three of the contracts, so we may have to have all three under executed contracts by the February time frame. As I mentioned, GMB is going to be the lead with Davis, Bell, and Friedel and Kate each doing a contract. The total proposed design contract is $872,000 relative to a $13.2 million construction budget. We also have a fourth work item that's associated with this that is outside the Oak Orchard expansion area number one on the River Road area. This is a leftover work item from the Oak Orchard original construction. If you recall, some of the council does. We were constructing the project and down in the River Road area in the vicinity of Indian River Yacht Basin. We happened upon some human remains that were located in River Road, and it basically put us in a position where at that time we couldn't extend the sewer line any further. So there was 20 to 25 homes that didn't receive sewer service that are right on the Indian River Bay. We've worked on this for a period of time since then, trying to come up with an approach. And what we did was we employed ground-penetrating radar to determine the extent of the human remains. And we now believe that there is enough room that we can route a sore trench, basically avoiding contact with the human remains, and extend the sore line as we originally proposed. However, to do that, the State Historic Preservation Office is mandating that we have an archaeological person present. We're going to go through, we're going to remove the surface of the road, and then we're going to remove 6 to 12 inches of soil. Basically, that is where most of your archaeological founds are would be present. And once you go deeper than that, you generally don't hit anything. So we're going to come through, have our contractor strip off this top soil surface with an archaeological person present, witness that there are no human remains, and then at that point we can bring back our utility contractor and do the actual sore construction. But even at that point, we need to still have someone present on site just to witness that there's no remains or like archaeological features being impacted.
And if they do see some, they stop?
We stop, yeah.
We basically, and then just get a new plan?
Well, it depends upon what you find. If you find like ceramic shards or things of that nature, you just catalog it and move on.
Right, okay.
Obviously,
human
if we hit human remains, then no. All bets are off and we're done.
Okay.
What did it find, a skull or something?
Excuse me?
What did it find? What part of the body?
An entire body.
Oh, yeah.
It's basically from the 1700s,
wow.
European in origin.
They never thought about digging them up and moving, did they?
Well, the thing is, to dig it up, yeah, we did. And we investigated that, but you have to do a lot of work. You have to determine the next of kin and go through a particular process. If you can't find the next of kin, you have to advertise it, and you have to go through a certain procedure to go in and remove the remains and take them to another location. For us, it's much easier if we can avoid the whole process.
And they're just left lying there?
Correct.
No, with no marker whatsoever or indicator or nothing? I'm just curious.
I know.
We don't know. It's not. That wouldn't be our job, right, to go back and maybe you have to plot it on a map or something. But
we try. It's in DelDOT's right away, so we tried to get DelDOT to address
it. It's DelDOT's problem.
They don't have the funding either.
You have a motion for us today?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Before you read that, does council have any questions for Mr. Izzo?
I do.
Okay.
This $3 million forgiveness, could you just refresh my memory on who forgives whom?
It's basically we will sign a loan document,
right,
borrowing $9 million, but you only have to pay back six.
Okay.
To grant.
Uh-huh.
You know, in effect, it's a grant. I'm not sure why they term it the way they do, but they refer to it as debt forgiveness.
Yeah.
Voodoo economics.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Be it moved, based upon the recommendation of the County Engineering Department, that the Sussex County Council authorize its president to execute an agreement with George Miles & Buer, LLC of Salisbury, Maryland, including subconsultant services by Davis Bowen & Friedel Incorporated and Cabe Associates Incorporated, to provide design services for the Oak Orchard Sanitary Sewer District, expansion area number 1, at a cost not to exceed $841,823, and design and archaeological services for Oak Orchard Sanitary Sewer District Contract Area F at a cost not to exceed $119,447.
So moved.
Second.
I have a motion and a second to approve the motion read by Mr. Izzo. Is there any further discussion?
I have just one quick question, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is it, I know why we've done all this, but is it less or more expensive to have three engineering firms versus a single firm?
There are cases where it would be a little cheaper. In this case, I think it's going to cost us a little bit more. In talking with Mr. Bozic, they have included about $30,000 to $35,000 of project and coordination to help implement the other firms. One reason I feel that's important in this case is because we have the deadline of the stimulus money. If I had an unending contract time, we didn't have to have everything done in a particular time. we probably would have fulfilled that activity ourselves, but in this case, we have a lot riding on it, $3 million. And with the other stimulus funding projects that we have, I felt like we needed some assistance in riding herd on the other two consultants to make sure the work gets done.
Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, we'll take the vote. Ms. Deaver?
Yes.
Mr. Vincent?
Yes.
Mr. Wilson?
Yes.
Mr. Cole?
Yes.
I vote yes. Motion carried. Thank you, Mike.
Great. Wonderful.
Mr. Lutke?
You're so optimistic.
Yes, I am.
You are.
I'm new.
You're bubbling.
I'm new.
That's okay. That's good.
Good afternoon. We're here today to talk to you about something that we've actually been researching for a couple of years now and are ready to make a recommendation on, and that is the use of the purchase of CPR assist devices. We know that on a national basis, sudden cardiac arrest kills 250,000 people annually. This figure comes from the American Heart Association. We respond to approximately between 200 and 250 such cases each year in Sussex County. Recent research has kind of changed the game plan for how we handle victims of cardiac arrest in a couple of ways. It really emphasizes the need for high-quality CPR. We've gone through periods, what goes around comes around. We went through the initial period when CPR was introduced, and yes, I was around then, and it was critical that you did everything absolutely up to par. We had machines that measured how deeply you pushed and how often and all that, and you had to have, quote, a perfect tape. We actually had a recording mannequin. You had to be absolutely perfect in order to be certified. In subsequent years, that seemed to become less important, and the standards were kind of relaxed. No longer had to produce a perfect tape. You merely needed to be good at it. What research has shown is that indeed we were probably right the first time, and that is that the quality of CPR directly relates to the survivability of a cardiac arrest. As a result of that and some other research that the Heart Association did, it was established that the protocols were actually changed. We used to, with a defibrillator, go right in and defibrillate immediately if we found a patient in cardiac arrest in certain rhythms. Now that's been changed, and we now do 2 minutes of CPR first because that enhances the ability of the defibrillation to work. We also, again, the research has also shown that the average provider can't maintain the highest quality of CPR for more than a minute or so. The rate has gone from, it used to be 80, it's now actually it was 60 at one time. Now it's 100 compressions per minute, and they're a little bit deeper. And you just flat get tired no matter who you are if you're doing that kind of work for that period of time. So we have, on the one hand, we have a standard that says, do it for at least 2 minutes prior to defibrillation. On the other hand, we have research that shows that we're not terribly efficient after that first minute. And indeed, now we trade off when we're doing manual CPR. We trade off much more often than we used to. In the meantime, devices have been developed that automatically perform the chest compressions, and that's the part that we're talking about because that's the part that's important. And we now have devices that allow for continuous CPR without a break, without any trade-offs, without anything. They just keep on going. In addition to the enhancement of survivability, there are also some safety concerns. And that is that during ambulance transport, it is not possible for a rescuer to be held firmly in a seat, to be restrained in any way. The fact that you're standing up, that you have to stand over the chest to perform compressions, you're kind of at the mercy of the elements. And any sudden move can place you at risk. We actually have some video that I will show you that proves that point. This was actually developed, if I can get... Now why did your finger work and mine didn't? Okay. This is taken in a moving ambulance. This was done by the Las Vegas Fire and Rescue Department. And they're moving, and you will see, you will also hear, but you will see that the least amount of movement of the ambulance will throw that rescuer off balance. It also results in interruptions, and we know that interruptions make the quality of the CPR less effective and reduce the possibility that we'll get the patient back. This, I think Mr. Vincent will agree, he's been in this position more than once. This is fairly common. There's no exaggeration here whatsoever. In talking with my colleagues, I don't think I've talked to one of us that hasn't been thrown up against the front wall or thrown off to the side while doing CPR in a moving ambulance. Now this compares to, this is one of the CPR devices that's out there. Look at the comparison of what's going on. The device on the patient on the right is automatically performing chest compressions, and you'll notice that both the rescuers are able to remain seated, able to do advanced life support maneuvers, do whatever they need to do, but the fact is that they're able to remain seated and restrained and safe, and that's really what this little demonstration is all about. The evaluation of these products was conducted by our professional standards manager, Alan Barnes. I'm going to ask Alan to come up and speak to you about what we did, how we did it, and what the results were.
Before, still a CIS code 3.
What we ended up doing is I've been looking at these devices for about 5 years, and in the different various conferences and things we go to, and in the journals that we look at, and there really are two main devices that are out there that are being used across the country. One is the AutoPulse device, which is a device you actually saw in the prior video. AutoPulse is a little different than the traditional CPR that you've seen performed on TV and you see in Mr. Vincent's seen in the back of the ambulance. It actually does a squeezing of the chest, and it's a new device that's out there, and we actually trialed that device for a while. And it is a device that uses the circumferential band that squeezes the chest. It runs off batteries, and one of the issues we had with that device was just that particular band is a single patient use. You throw it away and you pay another $120 to get a new band for your next patient. The other device that we looked at was the Lucas device, which is put out by Physio Control, which is the same company from whom we purchase our monitors right now, our cardiac monitors right now. It mirrors manual CPR. It has an anterior posterior, so it's the same type of motion that we do for CPR today. It runs on compressed air, similar to the Scott bottles that the firefighters use in their SCBA. And it has no disposable supplies at all. So we make the purchase, we use the device. Only thing we have to do is refill the compressed air cylinders, which the fire companies have been great with helping us refill during the trial. So we ended up looking at both devices. Over about the last 2 years we've been working on this. We started doing trials a little over a year ago. Actually, almost a year to the day. We started in May of last year. Physio Control was nice, and they loaned us enough devices to outfit our entire fleet of 8 frontline paramedic units, and we kept them for approximately 6 months, and we got to use them on 51 patients, which is a relatively large sample size compared to what most departments have done that have done evaluations. We kept them for a while, and before we decided to make a recommendation for purchase, we then moved on to the AutoPulse device, and Zoll was kind enough to give us 4 devices to put on half of our departments. Units, and we use them for approximately 3 months. And that's why you'll see a smaller number. They didn't give us as many units, and it wasn't over the summer, so we didn't have as many patients at that point in time. The process we used was we went and put them on the truck. They were used. These are FDA-approved devices. The state medical directors have approved the use of these devices for us, so we put them on the truck. They were used on patients like we would normally do CPR. They were used on cardiac arrest patients, and after each case, we had a questionnaire that was filled out by the paramedics that responded to the call. And the questionnaire included, how efficiently was it applied, because obviously we don't want a lot of lags when we're waiting to put the device on a patient, which seemed to work better for them. And we also said, what was the outcome? And one of the outcomes that we looked at is what we call return of spontaneous circulation. So a patient that was essentially dead, had no pulse, was not breathing, we perform our interventions, and then we end up getting a pulse back. And we kind of track that rate to see if there was a difference between the devices. At the end of each one of those cases, they were submitted the form into us, and when the entire evaluation was over, we compiled the forms and took a look at whether there was a preference, whether we had a significant difference in results. And at the very end of the entire study, we sent a survey out to our employees and said, which did you think worked better, which was easier for you to use, and compiled all that information. What we found out, honestly, was that both devices do a good job. The AutoPulse, the Zoll device, AutoPulse, and the Lucas device both did a good job. When we surveyed the field, the providers said 60% of the time preferred the Lucas device, the device with the piston that fires up and down. They said it was easier to use than the battery device, the AutoPulse device. It was more reliable. They had no failures where the device wouldn't actually function when they put it on. And it was lighter to carry, and they didn't have to worry about the batteries, a new battery system in the department. We also had spent some time talking to other agencies that surround us, and most of the agents we discussed with preferred the Lucas device. And you know, we have names of actual agencies that we talked to. So our recommendation is going to be, I guess that's you now.
Did you ask any patients what they liked?
That lived.
I don't think any of them would have liked the device. It's a harsh.
It seems harsh. It looks harsh.
But no, we never had a chance to actually interview the patients, although we did have several survivors.
The outcome was we had patients that we could have interviewed, which was, which in and of itself is kind of an accomplishment.
So the device that while you used them here locally, we actually saved some lives because device.
Absolutely. And the one thing I tried to be clear the whole time is that this was not a scientific study. These are FDA approved devices. And there were devices that just replaced what we do manually and do it much, much better. There's no way of scientifically saying, did we save more lives with the device or without the device? It was never planned to do it that way. We weren't trying to operate an IRB-approved study or anything like that. But yes, we absolutely had patients who walked out of the
hospital.
When
you're riding down the road is the key, when you saw that video where the guys were being shuffled around a little bit. And
I spent enough time in my career in the field being thrown into the
water. Well, I've seen those vehicles dodging, you know, lanes and different things. I'm sure it is hard for anybody standing up in the back.
Yeah, it is.
I would encourage you to get some better drivers, give them driving training.
Well, I mean, driver training is a part of the...
Especially if Sam's in the back.
Yeah. If you get me started on ambulance safety, you'll have me up here for a half hour. I don't think you want that today.
We don't have
but the fact,
half an
But
hour.
The fact is...
I don't want you to lose the patient and
I mean, if the fact is that these things do better CPR in the back of an ambulance than a person can do. It's just it's a matter of the mechanics. And they do better CPR overall. We know that these things will reduce the risk of serious injury to anyone in the back. This is not just about the paramedics. This is about everybody that rides in the back. Because usually, quite frankly, it's the basic EMTs who are performing CPR in the back while the paramedics are giving drugs and doing their thing, assuming we have enough personnel on board to do that. So it's safer for everybody that's in the back of that rig.
Is there a state requirement for this? Or?
No, ma'am. They are approved by the state, but they didn't want to lay an unfunded mandate on us. They said, these things are approved, and if you can get them, please do.
They're approved by the state.
Yes. Oh, yes, they are.
So they'll help fund them.
They will fund their percentage. The percentage that right now that's 40% of the state funding will apply to these devices.
Oh, okay.
We determined, and actually, I think Alan will agree with me. We were a little surprised. We thought our people were going to prefer the other device. But 60% of them preferred the Lucas device, and the Lucas seemed to do a better job than the other device did, based on what we saw.
But they're not requiring it. So if we don't have it, then
no, that's correct.
They're not requiring.
That's
okay.
Correct. It's not a requirement.
Do you give these people when you hire them in, do they have a fitness requirement or anything?
Yes, there is. Yeah, everybody that we hire gets a physical. Has to pass a physical exam in order to be hired.
Well, you made a mention in your presentation here that something about they gave out after about a minute or so.
Sorry?
You made in your presentation, you said it's kind of gave out after a minute or so.
Yeah.
It's hard
and that,
work, and I thought, well, that sounds like me. It must be pretty important to be physically in good shape.
Well, it is. But that's overall. That's heart. That's not our research. That's Heart Association research over a much larger sample of people than we can provide. But the fact is, it is hard work.
Yeah.
If you combine that with, you're doing it on the scene, if you don't get a return of circulation right then, you're in the back of the ambulance. Now you're moving down the road, waving around like you saw that guy do. You just can't do it as well as the machine can. That's just the bottom line on it. So what we're proposing is the purchase of 11 of the Lucas devices that will provide one for each of our road units, of our medic units, one for each supervisory unit, and one spare that we'll also use for training. plus the air cylinders and the regulators that go along with it. At a price of $165,712, that's a discount. That's a discounted price, and the amount of the discount is $29,304. So we did pretty well as far as bargaining for these things. We will receive 40% from the state through paramedic grant and aid, which will leave a total of $97,740 cost to the county. And we do have we had planned for this for some time, so there are sufficient funds budgeted for this purchase.
Are Kent County and New Castle County buying these also?
They're still doing their research. They've not moved on this yet.
We're number one again, then.
We're number one again.
All right.
Where we like to be.
It's good to
be
first.
Particularly for something like this, I think.
There are surrounding counties that are doing this. It's being done right now in Ocean City, Maryland. Caroline County is getting ready to make a purchase. I've been talking with the director of Caroline, who used to be one of our employees. Very, very.
Any other questions from council?
Be interesting. Sometimes I think you've got bought the west side some and the east side in comparison to who saved the most lives. Good comparison.
I don't have an answer for that.
Let me on the west side when you got the, when you got where you got.
I imagine we could break that down. We did, and in the testing process, we did see an increase in patients with return of spontaneous circulation. We didn't feel our sample size was big enough to declare that as Alan said, this was not a scientific study.
Over manual.
By any means, but over our previous experience, okay. Taking the same number of patients previously.
Do you have a motion, Mr.
We did see an increase.
Mike, are you familiar with these, I guess, in your
yes, somewhat.
Work? Mm-hmm. I mean, are you seeing?
I'm sort of familiar with standing up an ambulance doing CPR.
Very difficult.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Very difficult.
Probably, you and I probably both have some of the same lumps.
Yeah.
What do you feel that?
Well, I think it's certainly, I mean, you know, they've done the research and it looks to me like it's something we should be doing. I mean, it's certainly for two things. One, it's certainly, and I understand where Sam's question about the physical fitness of the CPR provider, but it is hard physical work at some point in time after you do that for a couple minutes.
It's,
and then standing up in the ambulance and doing that is certainly very unsafe, I guess you could put it that way. There's no better way of doing it. But now something like this allows them to not have to do that. Mm-hmm. So the EMTs haven't got to stand up and do it. Who are the ones that do it most of the time? So, yeah, it's a great idea, I think.
Have you got a motion?
Yes, sir, I do.
Please.
Be it moved that the Sussex County Council authorize the purchase of 11 Lucas CPR assist devices and other necessary equipment at a cost of $165,712.
So move you.
Is that in our budget?
Second.
Yes,
I have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? If not, we'll take the vote. Ms. Deaver?
Yes.
Mr. Vincent?
Yes.
Mr. Wilson?
Yes.
Mr. Cole?
Yes.
I vote yes. Motion carried.
Thank you. Thank you very much.